The history of Austin is people coming in from out of town and out of state and staying and loving it. That is what formed the city from the get-go. It was an artificial construct. Austin is the relief valve for Texas. Whatever you may think politically one way or the other about Texas, and everybody thinks something, me included, we are the blue island in a red state. We are where people come to party. We are where people come to try things, good or bad. Texas needs us, and of course we need Texas to sort of leave us alone and let us do this kind of thing. That forgiveness, that allowance that you could be yourself here, you could come here and you would be welcomed no matter where you came from or what you did, Austin still fulfills that, I think. And I expect we will continue to. And I'm in the business of that fulfillment. My name is Evan Voiles. I'm the owner of the Neon Jungle, which is a sign-making concern here in Austin, Texas. My wife and I joke about, you know, growing up in Texas, she assumed that, you know, I was on a horse before I could walk and learned to shoot a gun before I could talk and had an oil well in the backyard. And she's from New Jersey. I assume that she grew up wearing wife beater t-shirts and sitting on stoops eating Chinese food out of boxes. And of course she says, New Jersey's not like that and I wasn't like that. And I said, yeah, well, Texas is like what you described and that was me. I can remember my grandfather picking me up and putting me on a horse when I couldn't stand because I was terrified, of course. I was way up in the air and this huge animal. Here in Austin, I'm most well known for my work along South Congress because it's a lot of individual clients, and yet it represents a cluster of work. I've got 75 signs up at any time along South Congress. People love looking at them, and but of course, that whole exchange of looking at them and whatever you feel about them, as I've said before, it takes about 2 minutes, maybe, at best, and that's in your mind. On the street, 2 seconds.
Literally two seconds.
It used to be five, but now everybody's on their cell phone, so they're not even looking up. They're going to look up, and then they're going to look down. The 2 seconds is over. If I get 2 minutes of thought forming, that's a lot. And, of course, that's what I'm trying to do with my 2 seconds is set the hook and hope that it stays in there. And if they don't go in right now, that they'll come back later. The Terminix bug was at 12th and Lamar. And talk about an early memory of Austin. I fell in love with that sign the first time I saw it, and I was probably two. My dad had a Peugeot 404. Why he had a French automobile, I'll never know. It had a sunroof, and I'd never seen a sunroof before, and he would drive underneath that sign, and it was a pole sign, and the bug sat on top of the pole and would spin, and it was lit up in a kind of an unusual way. It was three-dimensional. It looked like a Godzilla movie in action. To tie it in with a memory, when I was three, there was a pizza place across the street, which is now Austin Land and Cattle. And my dad liked to get pizza there. And so he took me there one night, and he was picking up a pizza. And I said, can we go by the bug? And he said, no, we don't have time. We're in a hurry. Oh, come on, Dad. No. In fact, we're in such a hurry. I'm just going to leave you in the car, and I'm going to go in and get the pizza. I'll be right back. Don't touch anything. Well, you don't tell a three-year-old not to touch anything, especially when you've just told him you can't go see his favorite neon sign, bug. As soon as the screen door hits my dad's ass going in there, I'm playing with everything. And I get that car either in gear or in neutral, I don't know which. And I backed out into Lamar Boulevard, trying to get across the street to see the bug. And of course, I hit this Hispanic family in a Impala. And they were, of course, terrified because at first they think they're hitting a driverless car, which is bad enough because they can't see me because I'm down below the window in the seat. And this little kid. And then they're even more shocked when they get out and see that there's actually somebody driving the car. My dad hears the wreck, comes running out, sees his car's gone. It's in the middle of the street. Just give you an idea of how compelling a sign can be and the links I'll go to get to one. I was a full-fledged antique dealer, and I remember thinking, well, I'm just going to go out to New Mexico, Arizona, the Navajo Reservation. I'm going to buy old Navajo rugs, which I'd grown up with and loved, and jewelry and, you know, Indian artifacts, Western artifacts like that. I know they're out there. Well, I was wrong about that. I was about a generation too late. A wave of hippies in the 60s and 70s had beat me to the punch, and this was in the mid-80s. There were no great vintage rugs to be had, except in galleries in cities like Santa Fe, and I couldn't afford them, much less buy them and sell them for more. Mm. What I found, however, were there were cowboy boots in every thrift store in Texas for nothing. Mm. Texas was, this was in 86, there was been an economic downturn particular to Texas. Both oil and beef prices had collapsed, and so there was a serious shortage of funds down here, and thrift stores were popping up like mushrooms after a rainstorm. And so, you know, to use the modern analogy, I walked in with a bunch of California money and said, this stuff is great, I'm going to buy it all. Sound familiar? You know, all I was buying was cowboy boots they didn't even want, and I was taking them back to California where I could, you know, sell them for a big profit. I really did believe they were American folk art and that they should be appreciated in the same way that Navajo rugs were. So I started collecting more than I was dealing. Another way to put that is I became, as most junkies do, a dealer to finance my habit. I kept the best stuff and sold the other junk on the street. And I built quickly the world's biggest collection of vintage cowboy boots because I could. And as I began to meet other dealers, they said, are you crazy? You're keeping the stuff you could make the most money on. And I said, yeah, you're right, I am, but I think it's important that we have these. I want to build a museum-grade collection, and this time will pass where we can even find them. Boy, did it. It was fun, it was fast, and then it was over. In my case, it was over very suddenly. My place burned to the ground with my collection in it one night in July of 1994, and all I had left were the signs out back. They weren't hurt by the fire. So I was in the sign business overnight, literally. I tell you what, a Viking funeral like that is often the only way to get yourself out of a hot mess. And it was kind of a hot mess. I was obsessed. I was an addict, really, about, you know, I would do anything. I'd pawn my Land Cruiser to buy a pair of cowboy boots. That fire happened on a Sunday, and that Friday I had started calling museums and was talking to various directors or leaving messages for them and saying, look, you know who I am. You've seen the books, and you know I've got this collection, and I'm looking to part with it because I think I've really reached just about end game. There's a few things I want, but I don't know how long it's going to take me to get them. And so if they ever called me back, we'll never know, because in those days of answering machines, it melted. And of course, nobody wanted them burned. And I didn't have insurance because insurance cost a lot. I remember I had Lloyd's of London for a while because they'll insure anything for a price. But the premiums were such that I thought, oh, God, $250 a month. Think of the boots I could buy with that. I'll just skip one payment. Okay, I'll skip two payments. Ah, fuck, I don't need the insurance anyway. I need more boots. Yeah. You could literally say I was pretty heavily invested in Texas, but not in real estate, just in ephemera and in heritage. And you could also say I switched horses in midstream in the middle of the night. I went from boost to signs in the course of 24 hours. I'd already started collecting the signs, and I viewed them exactly the same way, that they were American folk art, that they represented a thing that was both useful and beautiful at the same time, and that that iconography is part of who we are and needed to be preserved. And so, like the boots, in fact, better than the boots, I've been able to build a collection of signs, and really was doing that before I started being a sign maker. The beauty of the signs were most of them were two-sided. Most of the boots I got were in a pair, but I couldn't sell one and keep the other. Everybody wanted the pair, whereas signs, they're going to hang them on the wall like paintings. So I typically would split them, and I'd keep half for the collection and still have it, and then would sell the other side. So I've got a collection of 200 killer Southwestern American vintage signs from the 1930s through the 1950s that I hope to someday place in a museum setting, because I think they're that good and I think they're that important and I think it's that surprising to people. The thing that's odd about Austin, for me anyway, because I'm born here, born and raised here, and then I left when I got out of high school, not because I didn't like it, but because I wanted to see the world. And Austin was a cool place to be from, but I didn't really think I was going to come back. When I did come back, what I discovered about Austin, and I couldn't have seen it, there was no sign you could have presented about this, but it was a really good place to get things done. It was a place you could try throwing your spaghetti against the wall to see if it stuck and have a chance of lasting long enough to find out if it would stick. You could try some crazy dream. It was cheap enough then, and there were enough people, this is before there were hipsters, there were just like-minded people who would say, yeah, I'll come to your art show with spaghetti and see if it stuck. If you'll come to my art show with my spaghetti, and I said, of course, will there be snacks and free drinks? I'll be at your show. And it really seemed like it worked that way for a while. And so sometimes I joke that Austin is a consensual hallucination, that we're all agreeing that we're having a good time here and it works, so it does work. When people ask me, are you going to stay? I say, yeah, I'm going to stay, partly because I helped make this mess. I'm partly responsible for what's going on. I'm making the window dressing that makes people come here. It would be not just unfriendly, but unrealistic and rude for me to leave having invited people in, as it were. I'm in the invitation business. So I'm going to stay and ride it out and steer it out and try to make it, you know, a good thing for the future. Partly that's my own work ethic, but it's also the right thing to do.